I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, friend, and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a part of the Agora Podcast Network. And the original Tudor podcast celebrating 15 years of telling Tudor stories this year. I'm your host, Heather, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and being much more in touch with our own humanity. So today we are talking about witchcraft. It is still Women's History Month. And we are going to talk about the accusations that I'm sure many, many women lived in fear of, and that was to be accused of being a witch. First, though, a big thank you to all of the patrons and members of this podcast, which help to keep it independent. Members get all kinds of perks like extra episodes, and depending on what level you're at, extra mini courses. This month, the course is Henry VIII, the Golden Prince. So it's going to be about an hour long, an audio course on the very early years of Henry VIII's reign when he was still considered to be the Golden Prince before he started, you know, killing everybody. So members who are at the appropriate level, watch out for the notifications on that in the next week or so. And if you would like to join or become a patron, depending on where you're watching this or listening, if you're just listening to the podcast, you can join on Patreon, patreon.com/englandcast, and you can choose the level and the perks, everything like that. If you're listening to this on YouTube, you can just click join this channel. And again, you'll have the choice of the perks and the levels. And that is that. So again, patreon.com/englandcast or click join this channel. Also, I only have 7 tickets left to TudorCon. So if you want to come to TudorCon September 20th to 22nd, Agecroft Hall, Richmond, Virginia, go to englandcast.com/TudorCon. And final announcement before we get into it. Some of you have heard me talk about the Tudor Mythbusting Challenge that is happening next week, the week of the 25th. It's a 5-day deep dive into the myths around the Tudors. So we're going to dig into the myths that the Tudors themselves created, as well as other things that have popped up throughout the years and why we still believe them. For example, that Anne Boleyn had 6 fingers, which is something that is still repeated today. Where does that come from and why? So Mythbusting the Tudors, it's a 5-day challenge. We'll have 2 live calls on the Monday and Friday. There will be 5 videos with handouts and everything like that. And it's just $17. So you can go to englandcast.com and there's a big button up in the top right that says Mythbusting the Tudors. Click that and you will have all of the details that you need. All right, my friends, let's get into it. Today we are delving into the shadowed corners of Tudor England where whispers of witchcraft stirred fear and fascination in equal measure. The belief in witchcraft during the Tudor period was deeply embedded in the fabric of society, intertwining remnants of ancient pagan rites with the stern doctrines of the Catholic faith and the Protestant faith. Before the Christian cross became ubiquitous, the English countryside pulsed with pagan rituals, celebrating the cycles of nature and invoking the favor of the earth and its spirits for bountiful harvests and protection against the unseen. However, As Christianity grew, these age-old customs didn't vanish. They transformed, sometimes merging with Christian practices, sometimes being cast into the darkness as heresy. The result was a rich but troubled mosaic of belief where old gods and new doctrines jostled for space in the collective consciousness of the Tudor people. Enter the Reformation, a cataclysm in the religious landscape that intensified the fear of witchcraft to unprecedented levels. The 16th century was a battleground of faith, with figures like Martin Luther challenging the Vatican's authority, Henry VIII reshaping England's spiritual allegiance to suit his desires. The Reformation wasn't just a theological dispute, it was a tectonic shift that unsettled the very foundations of society. Amidst this upheaval, witchcraft was perceived not merely as a relic of a pagan past, but as a dire threat to the Protestant ethos that increasingly dominated Tudor England. In a period where one's relationship with God was a matter of personal faith rather than mediated by priests, witchcraft represented the ultimate betrayal, a pact with the devil himself. But the fear of witchcraft was more than just spiritual anxiety. It was the mirror reflecting the era's social and political tumult. The Tudor period was marked by dramatic change. Enclosures dispossessed peasants, inflation gnawed at earnings, and the gentry's power grew. Amidst all of the religious upheaval, witchcraft accusations became a conduit for expressing broader social anxieties. The Tudor period was in that period of history in Europe referred to as the Little Ice Age, seeing cooler temperatures adversely affecting agriculture. There were specific years in the 1590s and the 1560s where there were particularly poor harvests, leading to widespread famine and increased mortality. The Elizabethan poor laws of the 1590s were a direct response to these crises, attempting to address the social fallout of failed crops and economic hardship. Plague outbreaks were another harrowing reality of Tudor life. The 16th century experienced several devastating waves of the plague, with notable outbreaks in 1563, 1593, 1603, each claiming tens of thousands of lives in London alone. These recurrent plagues not only decimated populations, but also fueled a pervasive sense of doom and helplessness, fertile ground for witchcraft fears to take root. In such tumultuous times, witchcraft provided a convenient scapegoat for unexplained misfortunes. It wasn't just crops failing or the death of livestock. It was seen as the malevolent will of a witch. As we delve deeper into the heart of Tudor witchcraft beliefs, we uncover a world where fear and suspicion reigned, where the natural and the supernatural blurred, and where accusations of witchcraft could arise from the most mundane misfortunes, turning neighbor against neighbor in a quest to explain the unexplainable. The intertwining of law, religion, and superstition manifested in legislation that sought to define and punish the crime of witchcraft. This legal framework reflected the era's social anxieties and the state's attempt to exert control over perceived threats to social and religious order. The legislative journey began with Henry VIII's Witchcraft Act of 1541, marking a pivotal moment in the criminalization of witchcraft. This act was groundbreaking, as it was the first to categorize witchcraft as a felony punishable by death and the forfeiture of the accused goods and chattels. It specifically targeted those who would, quote, use, practice, or exercise, or cause to be devised, practiced, or exercised, any invocations or conjurations of spirits, witchcrafts, enchantments, or sorceries for various nefarious purposes, including to waste, consume, or destroy any person in his body members, or to provoke unlawful love. This act notably removed the benefit of clergy as well, denying the accused the possibility of claiming clerical privileges to avoid harsh punishments. This statute, however, was repealed by Henry's son, Edward, in 1547, only to see fears surrounding witchcraft persist, necessitating further legal interventions under Elizabeth I and James I. Elizabeth I's Witchcraft Act of 1562 represented a somewhat more measured approach, reserving the death penalty for cases where witchcraft resulted in harm or death. Lesser offenses were met with imprisonment, reflecting a nuanced understanding of witchcraft's perceived threat. This act, passed on the 10th of April, 1563, made it clear that anyone found guilty of using witchcraft to kill or destroy was put to death, emphasizing the gravity with which the Tudor state viewed the threat of maleficent magic. Across the border, the Scottish Witchcraft Act of 1563 paralleled England's efforts, making both the practice of witchcraft and consulting with witches capital offenses. This act underscores the shared concerns across the Tudor domains about the perceived dangers of witchcraft and the necessity of stringent laws to combat these fears. The legal landscape shifted again under James I, who brought his own experience and obsessions with witchcraft from Scotland to England. The Witchcraft Act of 1603, enacted in the first year of his reign, expanded the scope of punishable offenses to include dealing with evil and wicked spirits. This act not only reinforced the death penalty for harmful witchcraft, but also targeted those who would seek to commune with spirits, reflecting James's personal preoccupations with demonic conspiracies. This legislation laid the groundwork for the infamous witch hunts of the early 17th century, including those conducted by the self-styled witchfinder general Matthew Hopkins. The judicial process for witch trials during this period was fraught with challenges, not least because the evidence was often intangible, based on accusations, confessions extracted under torture, and spectral evidence, testimony about apparitions or the actions of spirits. Torture, though officially frowned upon in England, was used particularly in the more notorious cases to extract confessions. Techniques varied, with the swimming test being one famous method where the accused, bound, was thrown into the water to see if they would sink, considered innocent, or float, considered guilty. These laws and the trials they engendered reveal the complex interplay of law, religion, and superstition in Tudor England, showing a society grappling with the unseen and the unknown, willing to enact harsh measures to protect the social order and religious orthodoxy from the threat of witchcraft. The witch trials of Tudor England and Scotland, often fueled by a mixture of fear, superstition, and social upheaval, disproportionately targeted women, casting them as scapegoats for a society grappling with the unknown. Among these, the Pendle witches and Eleanor Cobham stand out, illustrating how accusations of witchcraft could ensnare women from any stratum of society, from the noble to the commoner, often reflecting broader social anxieties and personal vendettas. The case of the Pendle witches in 1612 was one of the most infamous witch trials in English history, encapsulates the precarious position of women accused of witchcraft. This group, primarily composed of women from two families, fell victim to a combination of personal grudges, community tensions, and the zealous witch hunt atmosphere of the time. The trials were sparked by a seemingly mundane altercation involving Alison Device, a member of one of the families, who cursed a peddler, leading to his sudden illness. This incident spiraled into a series of accusations and confessions, entangling multiple members of the local community. The trials were characterized by dubious testimonies and the application of witch-finding methods, resulting in the execution of several individuals, including Alison Device. The Pendle witch trials highlight not only the vulnerability of women to accusations of witchcraft, but also the way in which such charges could be leveraged to settle personal scores or explain misfortunes. Eleanor Cobham's fall from grace is a poignant example of how high-status women were not immune to accusations of witchcraft, especially when political machinations were at play. As the Duchess of Gloucester, Eleanor found herself embroiled in a political struggle when she and several accomplices were accused of using necromancy and witchcraft to forecast the death of Henry VI. So this is a little bit before the Tudors, but it still illustrates our point. This, of course, forecasting the death of Henry VI was an act considered treasonous. Her case underscores the intersection of witchcraft accusations with political intrigue. Her downfall served to weaken her husband, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester's position at court. Eleanor's forced public penance and subsequent lifelong imprisonment illustrate the severe consequences faced by women accused of witchcraft, regardless of their social standing, and the ease with which such charges could be used as weapons in political disputes. These cases shed light on the complex web of factors that made women vulnerable to accusations of witchcraft. Economic distress, such as the crop failures and famines that plagued England intermittently throughout the Tudor period, often led to social tensions that found an outlet in witch trials. Personal vendettas and community conflicts could easily escalate into formal accusations, with women frequently at the center of these disputes. The patriarchal structure of Tudor society meant that women's behavior was closely scrutinized, with any deviation from the norm potentially leading to accusations of witchcraft. Witchcraft accusations were not merely isolated incidents of superstition gone awry, but were deeply interwoven with the fabric of Tudor society, reflecting the underlying tensions and fears about women's roles, sexuality, and the dynamics of power. Women, especially those who were widowed, elderly, or otherwise independent, were often viewed with suspicion. Their autonomy, particularly in matters of land ownership or herbal medicine, could be perceived as a direct challenge to the patriarchal structure. This was a time when the ideal woman was expected to be chaste, obedient, and silent, a notion enshrined in contemporary literature and law. Those who deviated from these expectations, intentionally or not, found themselves at risk of being labeled witches, a label that connotated not just malevolence, but also a perverse inversion of the feminine ideal. Tudor society's anxieties about female sexuality also found expression through witchcraft accusations. The Malleus Maleficarum, a witch-hunting manual that enjoyed widespread popularity well into the Tudor period, explicitly linked witchcraft with female sexuality, painting women as inherently more susceptible to demonic seduction. This association made women's sexual autonomy a matter of both moral and supernatural concern, rendering them vulnerable to accusations that could arise from anything as innocuous as a spurned suitor to childbirth complications within the community. Economic distress also significantly amplified the witchcraft hysteria in Tudor England. Periods marked by poor harvests, such as the difficult years of the 1590s, saw a notable uptick in witch trials. The reasoning was twofold. Firstly, the tangible hardships of famine and disease heightened communal stress and the need for a scapegoat. Secondly, these conditions often led to increased visibility and activity of cunning folk as communities sought their aid to mitigate these hardships, inadvertently increasing their risk of accusation. In this context, witchcraft accusations served as a mechanism for communities to articulate their frustrations and fears, often at the expense of the most vulnerable members. Witchcraft accusations were rarely about the supernatural in isolation. Instead, they were deeply embedded in the social, economic, and political fabric of the time. The figure of the witch became a repository for communal anxieties, a symbol through which society negotiated its fears and uncertainties. Understanding the context and content of these accusations offers an insight into the complex ways in which Tudor society grappled with issues of power, gender, and community cohesion, often using the vulnerable as scapegoats for broader societal ills. As the Tudor period gave way to the Stuart era, the fervor that had fueled the witch trials began to wane, leading to a gradual decline in their frequency and intensity. This shift was influenced by a complex interplay of factors, including changing legal practices, evolving societal attitudes, and a growing skepticism among the educated elite regarding the existence of witchcraft. The transition from Tudor to Stuart saw a gradual transformation in the legal landscape concerning witchcraft. Under the early Stuarts, there was a notable shift towards a more skeptical and critical approach to witch trials. The early 17th century witnessed the publication of works that questioned the validity of witchcraft accusations and the reliability of evidence used in trials. Of course, James I was obsessed with witchcraft and wanted to hunt them and engaged in a lot of really kind of obsessive behavior towards witches. And I did an episode on James I and witchcraft several years ago. But then there was a backlash against that as well. So this period also saw an increased emphasis on more rigorous legal procedures, which demanded higher standards of evidence and began to curb the excesses that had characterized the earlier trials. A key factor in the decline of witch trials was the growing skepticism of witchcraft among the educated classes. Influential figures such as Reginald Scott, whose work, The Discovery of Witchcraft, openly mocked the belief in witches and criticized the methods of their prosecution, played a significant role in the changing public perceptions. This growing skepticism was further bolstered by the Enlightenment's emphasis on reason and empirical evidence, which challenged the superstitious beliefs that underpinned the witch trials. Interestingly, the legend is that when James I ascended to the throne, he actually got all the obtainable copies of the book by Reginald Scott and burned them because he, of course, like I said, was obsessed with witches. The legacy of the Tudor witch trials is profound and multifaceted, resonating through the centuries, influencing modern perceptions of witchcraft and feminism. The trials left an indelible mark on the collective memory, serving as a cautionary tale about the dangers of hysteria, scapegoating, and the marginalization of the vulnerable. In feminist discourse, the witch trials are often cited as an early example of sex-based persecution, highlighting the ways in which fears of female power and autonomy were projected onto the figure of the witch. Today, the image of the witch has been reclaimed by some as a symbol of female empowerment and resistance against patriarchal oppression. The narrative of the persecuted witch has been embraced by various feminist and neo-pagan movements, transforming the witch from a figure of fear to one of strength and autonomy. So there we have it. Women witches in Tudor England. I hope you've enjoyed this. Let me know. You can always text the listener support line at 8016-TESCO, or you can join the Tudor Learning Circle, tutorlearningcircle.com, which is the internet's only social media site just for Tudor nerds. There's a lot more going on there these days. Of course, we'll be having TudorCon streaming tickets will be taking place in there as well. So hop on in and share your thoughts on witches or anything Tudor related. I would love to see you in there. Again, Patreon, patreon.com/englandcast if you want to get extra episodes. The extra episode this week is on Tudor women and the law, so stay tuned for that. The mini courses this week is on, or this month is on Henry VIII, the Golden Prince, as well as lots of other fun things. Okay, my friends, thank you so much for your support, for your listenership. I will be back again next week. We're going to be talking about women's education and literacy and role in religion. So still Women's History Month, still digging deep into women's subjects. I haven't decided yet what April will be, what kind of month April will be. But you know what? When I do the research for these episodes, I always find other things that I want to dig into more. So maybe April will just be Heather's random catch up on things she wants to talk about month. We'll see. All right. Thank you for listening, my friend. I will be back soon. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Blow, northern wind, a scent for baby sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ich hörte Bord in Bauerbrick, at Solis Emlis on sich. Mensch, cool, meiden auf mich, fern frei.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea's sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.